Speaker is Frank C. from Los Angeles, California.
All right, welcome, buddy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I want to thank Tom for introducing me. I want to thank my friend Bob for asking me to come and share. This is an honor and a privilege. My sponsor was always quick to remind me that speaking is probably the least significant commitment I could have in AA. And I need to remember that every time I go to speak. And I think what he meant by that was that, first off, he knew what kind of ego I had. So, you know, he knew I needed to hear that. But mainly, I think what he meant was that, you know, I've never been to this group before. I got to tell you, I felt so welcomed here, and it's been a wonderful experience. But, you know, I've been asked to come here one time to run my mouth about me for 45 minutes and then get the heck out of town. You know, now what kind of commitment is that? That'll get you drunk, you know. And I think what he meant was it was those kinds of commitments like the people that make this coffee or set up those tapes or sell the literature or clean up the room afterwards or help set it up in the beginning. Those are the commitments that keep me coming back, that reduce my isolation. I have to show up for them, especially when I don't feel like I want to. Those are the commitments that saved my life. And it took me 3 years to remember anything a speaker said anyway when I came in here. So you're going to see this hand move around some. I say if you're new and you think my hand's shaking, you're seeing things. About 7 years ago, I got diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and it's the least of what's wrong with me, trust me. But if you're new and you think my hand's shaking or doing a number while I'm up here, you're not crazy, it is. You're not seeing things, you know. I feel like that Dr. Strangelove, I don't know if you're, I'm dating myself, but it used to be an old Peter Sellers movie where you had that hand and it went like attacking. So you can either watch my handshake or listen to what I got to say, you know. You know, you want to hear something funny. When I got this diagnosed, you know, I went to the doctor. And I'd never seen a neurologist before. And he's sitting there and he's diagnosed. And he says, what's up? And I said, well, my hand won't, it just shakes. It won't stop shaking. And he looked at it and he says, well, how does it respond to alcohol? That is the first question he asked. I said, doc, you don't want an answer to that question. So I guess what it is, my hand needs a drink, you know. You know. You know, I paid $500 for that piece of information, you know. Hell, I could have told him that before I went in there. Oh, man. So now we've covered the dance routine I do with this hand and the medication I took, which keeps it supposedly reimburses my adrenaline and... Well, actually, it's the opposite of it's a long story. Ask my doctor what that does, but it doesn't affect me from the neck up, so thank God. When I say it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do this, speaking for me is an opportunity to remember from whence I come. Who I was when I got here. Like they say, we're not a glum lot. But there's a line in chapter 2 in the book, which is also where I think this group gets its name. I love the name of this group, the specific group. That's the first time I read in the book, which they read in the beginning, and there is a solution, that specifically what we do to acquire psychic change that takes me from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. When I got to AA, I was useless. I always call it a dog on a freeway. I was a road hazard in the way. I had nothing to give, and if I'd had anything, I wouldn't have been interested in giving it. I lived in a dog-eat-dog hostile world. I was out to get mine before you took it away from me. I was, I had blood on my face, blood on my hands, holes in my jeans. I was a useless human being. That was the world I lived in, a world of terror. And anything that I have that's of any value, anything that I see myself to be, any sense of self, but most especially, anything I do that's of any use to anybody, any service I render on this planet, is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps that it brought into my life in this fellowship. And it's a debt I will never pay back, that I never say no to. And so it is an honor and a privilege to serve AA in any way I can, but most especially to be asked to come and share with you tonight. So thank you very much, Bob. My sponsor was always quick to remind me that, or show me, one of the first things he showed me about the steps. He said the fellowship was going to bring me an awareness. It was going to bring me a certain stability. He says, you never leave a meeting that you don't know when your next meeting is. And you stay conscious between the meetings. And what will happen is I will find a way to own a big book. And then once I own that book, you know, in a certain amount of time, I will get to the point of being able to read the big book. And it will introduce me to 12 steps. And he said the first 11 words of the 12th step was having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. He said it was the only thing we were working on. It's all that this is about. I want to thank you for your pitch, Bill. Thanks for sharing. That was really wonderful. And I can tell how excited you are. And you can see in what Bill shared with us that he can't shut up about it, you know? And so, and I can't either. It's exciting. You know, in that second chapter of the big book, it also talks about the fourth dimension. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I've had a glimpse into an experience that I can't tell you. If you knew, I can't tell you what that is. There's no words for it. But I can try. And I can let you see my enthusiasm for it and how blown away I am, because it's not something I can describe. It doesn't reside within the three-dimensional world that I lived in when I got here. By the way, that world rendered me useless. If I don't get to tell you anything else about what I'm talking about, I'm going to tell you my story. But in case you want to cut out of here early, I'm going to give you the short form first. My sobriety date is December. Those pills are kicking in, you know. December 20th, 5 days before Christmas, which was later explained to me, really kind of a sick sobriety date, you know, but I didn't know what day it was, let alone what time of year it was, but December 20th, 1982. So I just turned, I guess that's 23 years. You do the math on it. But the point is for me, that's a long time between drinks. And my son is 19 years old. I'm 23 years sober. Now, when I began speaking with you tonight, I wanted to get in touch with the gratitude that I have for being here, because anything I do that's of any use to anybody is a result of this program. Well, I didn't come here to learn how to be a parent. That was not in the cards for a guy like me. I came here to learn how to stop knocking teeth loose in my head and falling down drunk and skinning my face and hands on the sidewalk and sleeping on the streets. I came here to learn how to drink again. I did not come here to learn how to be a parent. And my best friend today is my 19-year-old son. When he was 4 years old, every morning, Saturday morning, he used to spend his time watching Saturday morning cartoons. And I learned to make pancakes. I got pretty good at flipping pancakes, which is an amazing thing when you hear the rest of my story. But his favorite cartoon was this Roadrunner cartoon. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And Roadrunner goes beep, beep, you know. And we used to watch that, and I'd be on the phone with my friend Jimmy, and he was in the program and had a daughter about his age, and we were both single fathers. And we decided that one of us must have written this cartoon. Now, here's the story. You got this Wile E. Coyote, this dog, and we decided that if you go back far enough in the Roadrunners, you're going to find that he actually caught a Roadrunner, and he ate this bird. And it was Bugs Bunny Day, man. It fixed him. It was a spiritual experience. He ate this Roadrunner, and all was well. It made him complete and whole, and nothing was missing. And now he's going to spend the rest of his life buying Acme rockets, straddling on and running his head in the side of a mountain, just to get one more bite of Roadrunner. Oh, yeah, baby. Yeah. And no matter how busy he gets, no matter what else is going on that day, he always knows where the Roadrunner is. He can always pinpoint him to the point. And the great one, now this is a great one. I couldn't believe this when I saw this. And I thought, yeah, I don't know about you, but that's my story. And here's the great one. This completely describes me. Now, if you're new here tonight, what I want to tell you is that what I'm saying and what I'm realizing and everything I have to say about this is in hindsight. It's 20/20 hindsight. If you want to know what's going on with me this week, ask me next week, because I can't tell you to this day what the hell's going on right now. But I can look back at my drinking, and I can tell you that all kinds of things are revealed. And this was the greatest scene. I remember thinking of that analogy, and then starting to watch this cartoon as if it were my story. I'm like this Wile E. Coyote guy, you know. And there was this one episode where, may have been more than one, but the one I saw, and I mean, it was a spiritual experience. This dog is chasing a Roadrunner. He goes off a cliff at the end of the episode. And you know how they freeze it for about 2 seconds before he looks down and sees that he's got about 350-foot fall off this cliff. He hasn't dropped yet. The camera's staring him in the face. He's got Band-Aids on his face. He's got a bandage on his head. And right before he falls, now this is very profound, he smiles at the camera and whips out this sign and it says, genius. That's what our kids are watching, you know. I thought, one of us has got to have written that cartoon. And that's my story. So now I'll tell you the specifics, to be specific. But it's not going to be much more of a point to it than that. How does that Roadrunner get fixed? What's wrong with that dog? And would there ever be a time, other than eating a Roadrunner, that he could feel complete, whole, and entire without running around like that? And that's what, you know, a psychic change is all about. And we laugh, I think, because we've hit the end of the cartoon. See, the truth is my kid wouldn't be interested in a fixed roadrunner. What makes him funny is that he's broken. But it ain't funny, and by the time I got to this fellowship, I'm from Beaumont, Texas originally. Beaumont's about 90 miles east of Houston. It's 5 miles west of Louisiana state line. The significance of that in my sobriety, I was 14 in 1967. So that makes me 52 and change. You don't have to think about it. I'll tell you right now. That's how old I am. And when I was 14 in 1967 in the state of Texas, you could get a driver's license legally. And you couldn't drive in Louisiana till you were 18. Now, in Texas, you couldn't drink till you're 21, but you could drink in Louisiana at 18. But you couldn't drive in Louisiana until you were 18. So if you were old enough to drive in Louisiana, bottom line, you were old enough to drink. And that was like my kind of state. And my dad had given me a 58 Chevy Delray. Now, I don't know if you ever saw a 58 Chevy Delray, but it's a huge tank of a car. I was 14 years old, had a license to drive it, and I got to hang out with a lot of guys older than me. They were 16 to 18, so I thought this made me cool. There were six of them, one of me. We called ourselves the Magnificent Seven. We would pile these guys into this 58 Chevy on the weekends, and we'd tool 5 miles over the Louisiana state line to Vinton, Louisiana. In the first exit off the highway, there was a little old white liquor store. It's called Jack's Packet. And you could pull up in this oyster shell driveway, and the shells under the car, I can hear them crackling. Now, I mean, it was a spiritual experience, man. This is romantic as hell, you know. We'd pull up to the drive-up window in the back, and you wouldn't even have to get out of the car. It was like a McDonald's drive-thru. There'd be like some 300-pound guy with a cigar, bald, hanging out of his mouth, stick his head out the window, and he'd say, "What can I do for you boys?" We'd buy like 3 bottles of Boone's Farm apple wine and Boone's Farm strawberry wine. My favorite was this big gallon bottle of Bally High wine. You could get that for $1.59. It was amazing what this wine did for me. $1.59, you get a psychic change, you know. It was better than catching a roadrunner, trust me. And I'm convinced to this day they call it Bally High. Had this little hula girl dancing on the label. Very sexy. And I'm convinced to this day they call it Bally High because you drink that bottle, that's how you say I'm very high. I'm Bally High, you know. You want to be Bally High, you know. And I have craved a spiritual experience my entire life. That's what I need. I got a hole in me that seems a little bigger than the average bear around me. It keeps me away from them. It isolates me. It makes me feel different and less than. And I've got to feel that to be a part of this world around me. And that's what that did for me. I crave to be fixed. I crave to be whole and complete. And I crave my spiritual experience. So I didn't care what Bally High did to me because of what it did for me. Oh, man. You know, I can even think of it to this day. I mean, the relief I felt when I discovered that booze. And that's where my drinking started. And I can paint you pictures of it to this day, like Polaroids in my head. We would tool out. We would have enough money left. We'd buy like this long neck Pearl beer. Remember Pearl beer, TJ? And I mean, whatever. And we'd buy this long neck Pearl beer, and we'd have enough money left over for one admission to Showtown USA Drive-In, which was right on the other side of drive-in movie theater. We piled 6 guys in the trunk of the car. I had this one 14-year-old kid driving this 58 Chevy, paid for one, and the rear end of the car is dragging on the ground, making sparks. And That's where it all started. When I was 19 years old, I went off looking for bigger and better highs. Like I say, I never felt like I belonged where I came from. My family always seemed like a bunch of strangers to me. And my earliest conscious memory is thinking, who are these people and get me out of here? My father was the local dean of engineering at the university. My mother's 87 years old today, lives in Beaumont, and still teaches the same Sunday school class. My sister was the valedictorian of the high school. She was 6 years older than me. And to this day, they wonder, what the hell happened to me? You know, because when I was 19, I ran away from home, went to New York City, took a job driving a cab in the South Bronx for the next 3 years, and looking for bigger and better highs, chasing the Roadrunner. When I was 21, my father died. I hadn't talked to him for 2 years, and I didn't expect that to be the end of that story. Went home, buried my father. My sister, like I say, was 6 years older than me. When I was 25, she was 31. She was on a Fulbright scholarship to the University of Cologne in Germany. Got an aneurysm in the front lobe of her brain, went into a coma, and died. And she had a 2-year-old son, and he was like the only contact of the family I had. When you're 2, you hadn't learned to judge too much yet, and I felt like he was the only one that would accept me in the family. I held him in my arms while my mother buried her daughter, and I swore off God. I decided if there was anybody who was supposed to be dead in this deal, it was me and not her, and that was the beginning of the bottom for me. In 1980, I tell you a trick. If you want to go back out there and you're new, and you have a problem with blackout drinking, which I did, the trick I discovered was that for free and for fun, if you find a newsstand, it'll tell you everything you need to know. Top 2 inches of a newspaper will tell you where you are and what day it is. And I was a blackout drinker. And so I would come out of these blackouts in New York City, and I'd go to a newsstand to see how long I'd been blacked out. And I saw a picture in 1980 of Richard Pryor, and I recognized him. And he was running down Ventura Boulevard in L.A. on fire. Now, if you're Wile E. Coyote, that looks like a great idea, you know? So I got a job and came to Los Angeles chasing bigger and better highs. And came out here. And by 1982, I'd made a lot of money in a little bit of time, but was in thousands of dollars worth of debt to the wrong kind of people. And a week before Thanksgiving in 1982, a buddy of mine was coming over to get ready for a party. And I remember it was a Thursday because it was a week before Thanksgiving. And it was about 3 p.m. The party was like 9 o'clock that night, and we had to get ready for it. So, you know, you had to get loaded to get ready to go out. You know, you can't face the world conscious. So he comes over, and I was living at a girlfriend's house. And like I said, I was in a lot of debt, so I didn't have any money. And all she had to drink was this bottle of Tanqueray gin. And I hated gin. But he had brought something to smoke, and he's loading a pipe on the table. And I figured, I grabbed these 2 water glasses, I put them down. And to this day, that's the last Polaroid I have of what I think was my last blackout. I took this Tanqueray, and I poured those 2 water glasses full of gin. The next thing I knew, it was Monday morning. I was lying face down on the southeast corner of Hollywood and Vine. There's a little novelty shop there, and people are walking over me and looking at me like I used to look at the bums on the subways. And I thought, how the hell did I get here? I didn't even remember getting high. It was like the click. Remember when I talked about drinking that Valley High wine and what it did for you? I didn't care what it did to me because of what it did for me. Well, it stopped doing anything for me. Actually, that's not true. It did a lot for me, but I didn't remember. You know, it's like, what's the point? So I figured I had to do something to learn how to drink again. And I was terrified. that morning, that Monday morning for Thanksgiving in 82, I'm on that corner, and people are looking at me, and I am that dog on the freeway. I remember I had this old denim jacket on. I probably hadn't had it off for a couple of years. I reached in the pockets, and in one pocket there was 37 cents. I had a quarter, a dime, two pennies. The other pocket, there was a little piece of yellow torn-off legal pad, and it had a phone number on it. Said Michael with a phone number. Now, I remembered this guy. I used to drink with this guy, Michael, and I had seen him in another blackout 2 or 3 months before at a party in a bar, and he'd been drinking this Perrier. And I went up to him, and I said, what the hell are you drinking a Perrier for? Let me buy you a drink. He says, no, I hadn't had a drink in a year and a half. I said, that's terrible, man. Let me get you a drink. You don't have to do that to yourself. He said, no, no. He says, I've been going to AA. Well, that was the end of that conversation that night. And somewhere in my blackout that night, he had slipped me this phone number. Now, the miracle is not that he would slip a blacked out drunk his phone number or what it is that we do around here, which is all a part of the miracle. The miracle is the whole picture. But I think the gift for me that day and what it says to me about a bottom is for some reason I was in a space that Monday to not think and to call the number. My mind is where my disease is centered. And if I had blown my mind that morning and I could only go pushed by some force other than my mind. And I had to take that number and I didn't think. And I didn't know what space I was in, this space of grace. But I picked up that phone and I called him. And right away he recognized who I was and he says, where are you? And I told him. What must have been about 20 minutes, but felt like 2 minutes. He comes pulling up in his car. He throws open the door. He says, get in. We're going to go to a meeting. Now, I was convinced that this guy was the president of AA, you know. I mean, everybody knew him. And we went to this meeting, and I'm a very vain guy, and I didn't look good that morning. I had blood on my face. My hand has a scar on it to this day where it was stuck to the sidewalk. I had holes in my jeans that was not fashionable in 82. They had gotten there from falling down. Blood on my pants. And I didn't want to go around a bunch of people that look like you. But you, now here's the deal. I don't remember that much about that meeting, and I was hungover. But something impressed me. If you want to approach a dog on a freeway, how would you go up to an animal like that? It was real funny. This morning they had a news story about some whippet dog that was in the dog show. I don't know if you saw that. And it escaped from LAX, and it was out in some of the surrounding areas. And they were training the law enforcement officers how to go get that dog. These dogs apparently are very terrified naturally. And they said, you got to get down on its level. And you've got to smile. And I guess offer it something to make it come to you or whatever. And I thought, that's what you did for me. You know, it sounds crazy. But I went to this room. And when you live in a hostile world and feeling the way I felt, people were coming up to me and they were saying things like, hey, my name's Joe. I know your friend Michael. We're glad you're here. And I can remember, it took me a while. Like I say, it's 20/20 hindsight. But I can remember looking them square in the eye and a guy saying to me, I'm glad you're here. When I woke up on the sidewalk that morning, he better be telling the truth. And they were. I somehow knew. I trusted it. They said, we're really glad you're here. Your friend Michael sits there. Why don't you sit here next to him? What do you want in your coffee? To this day, he gives me a hard time. I ask him, I said, listen, man, I had 37 cents on me. I spent it calling you this morning. Can you spot me a cup of coffee? He said, it's for free. He was tempted to say, it's $5 and you'll owe me the rest of your life. I said, free coffee? I was impressed. We went through that meeting. Like I said, I don't remember that much about it. But it was these little things the fact that everyone in the room seemed to know my friend Michael. It couldn't have been me that you thought was important. That wouldn't have made any sense in the world that I lived in. So it must have been my friend Michael that was so important, because everybody in the room came by his chair where I was sitting next to him. When that meeting was over, I remember, the next thing I remember was the meeting was clearing out. There was a guy in the back of the room. He had a three-piece suit with a red carnation in his lapel. This guy's name was Bob, and that's a whole other story. I'll tell you some other time. It was amazing. I mean, all this looking back is just the providence in it. But he had this three-piece Brooks Brothers suit, red carnation. I thought he was a narc. I mean, when you look like I looked, a guy like that doesn't approach you unless you're in trouble, you know. And he comes running across the room like he's going to make a beeline for me. I thought, who is this guy? He goes, my name's Bob. It's nice to meet you. He says, when's your next meeting? I said, there are others. I didn't know. He says, yeah. He says, there's one tonight at 7:30. It's the old Chicago group on Camden and Santa Monica. I don't know if you remember that one, Bob. But he says, I'm going to be there. Your friend Michael's going to be there. Three or four of us are going to be. Why don't you show up at that meeting tonight at 7:30? I said, well, let me check my calendar and I'll get back to you. Of course, I had no calendar. I didn't say that. And I said, okay. And he says, great, we'll see you tonight. And he picks up his briefcase, he's walking out the door dressed like this, and he remembers something, like he'd forgotten something. He turns around and he says, wait a second. I said, yeah. He says, it's about 2 in the afternoon. You're not going to drink between now and 7:30 tonight, are you? And I guess I took too long answering that question. Because what he did was, he got four other guys. He says, we're going to go to coffee. And they took me out to Figaro Restaurant. They put me on the inside of the booth where I couldn't get out. They sat on the outside. They bought me coffee and fed me cigarettes for the next 4 hours. Every half hour or hour, some other guy I'd never met before would walk in. He'd say, hey, I'm Joe. Nice to meet you. I'm a friend of your friend Mike's. Let me buy you a cup of coffee, you know. And he'd sit there. They walked me to that next meeting that night. I don't remember that much else except that I passed out on my friend's couch that night after the second meeting. It was about 11 in the morning on Tuesday. There's the next thing I remember. He was waking me up on his couch. He says, come on, we got to go to another one of them meetings. And there's a noon meeting in West Hollywood every day, Monday through Friday, which is where we were. And I said, okay. He says, we're going back to that new meeting. He threw me in the car. And to make conversation on the way there, he said, listen, man, this is, you called me yesterday morning about 10 a.m. And he's just making conversation. He says, I know you didn't drink between those two meetings yesterday. He says, I'm pretty sure you've been passed out on my couch since then. He says, now it's 11 o'clock this morning. You call me at 10. He says, you got a day. Now, I remember that. I was riding in his car, and I remember him saying that, and it scared the dickens out of me. I couldn't think since I was 14 years old in Showtown USA Drive-In, going one day, one complete 24-hour period, not only being conscious, but actually kind of enjoying it. Or finding some pleasure in it. That was like Wile E. Coyote forgetting where the Roadrunner is. How can that be possible? Yet it scared me too. It was terrifying. We went up to that architect's meeting that Tuesday morning. The same people were there greeting me that were there the day before. They said, it's great to see you. You sit here. And a funny thing happened. And I, like I say, this is 20/20 hindsight. But I look back and I realize that in one day, somehow these people could look at me and they knew I had been conscious for 24 hours. They knew that somehow they had asked me to do something and I had shown up and done it. I hadn't had any integrity in my life. I had no truth in my life. I had no opportunity to be of service. I was a useless dog on a freeway. And in one day, I looked back and somehow I had been of that much service to these people around me. I had that much, just a grain of truth in my life, a grain of integrity. I had done one thing for one day that I said I was going to do. That's the way this program has worked for me. This fellowship and asking me to show up and reducing my isolation has brought to me that sense enough that I got conscious enough to be able to read again. And then they gave me this book. I read the book and stepped. But that's where it started for me. When I was 90 days sober, I'll tell you this story. This is my first story of surrender. To me, the first three steps got given to me. That was the first step for me when I came into this program and what was happening. It was coming from I look back and I realize it took me a while to see that this was coming from some dimension I had never lived in before, because the world was still a hostile place and all I could see was what I didn't have, the hole in me, my incompleteness, and how you were responsible for it. That was the only perspective I had. And slowly from coming to these meetings, that was becoming shifted. When I had 90 days sobriety, I was told by my sponsor that I had to go to this one big noon meeting Wednesday in L.A. that everybody went to. There was probably at least as many, maybe more people than are here tonight. And I had to go to this meeting and take a chip. They gave chips at this meeting. And my sponsor said, get there early because you're going to need to take a chip. You got 90 days and that's a big deal. And I said, oh, really? He says, yeah. I said, okay. And this meeting had been attended by a guy named Irv Neamy. Irv died in 1987 or 89. He had over 30 years of sobriety, and it's like he got sober with Jesus or something, you know. And he sat on the front left of this meeting every Wednesday. That was Irv's meeting. I knew guys that knew Irv, but I had never talked to Irv. I didn't have a lot of spirituality in my life at this point, but that would be about as close to God as I was going to get, was Irv Neamy. Because, I mean, over 30 years, I had 90 days. It's like, that's impossible. You know, you might as well have never drank. And I got there early to save this seat. And Irv's walking one way, I'm walking the other. He stops and he looks at me and he says, hey, how you doing? And there wasn't a lot of people around in that meeting that morning. And I looked around and I saw that a couple of people had seen him ask me that. And he's waiting for an answer. Now, if God asks you how you're doing, you got to tell him the truth, you know. So I took this opportunity and I looked at Irv and I said, I'm pathetic. He said, excuse me? I said, I'm pathetic, man. My ass is falling off. I've been living on a friend's couch for the last 90 days. I'm in thousands of dollars worth of debt to the wrong kind of people. I've been coming to these stupid meetings. I used to bartend and deal drugs, and I can't do that anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do for money. I can't find my car. I still got a car, but it took me 6 months to find my car. I didn't know where I'd left it. And even if I did find it, I couldn't drive it because my girlfriend's got the keys and she won't pick up my calls. So I'm pathetic. I'm terrible. How are you? Well, it's like Irv didn't even see me, man. He's got this crazy newcomer in his face. Irv's from Brooklyn, you know. He's got that attitude, Jerry. And he says, you know this guy in the back of the room? And I said, what are you talking about? And I'm looking behind me. It's like he's not even looking at me. He's looking beyond me. And I said, no. And he says, that guy's name's Jeff. Now, this is back when people used to smoke in meetings. And this guy had like a stack of aluminum ashtrays that were, he was balancing about a foot high. He He said, this meeting's going to start in about 10 minutes. That's how long he's got to put all them ashtrays out. Why don't you go over there and help Jeff with them ashtrays? Okay, let's review this situation. I got 90 days. I'm doing what my sponsor tells me to do. I got there early. I see God. God wants to know how I'm doing. I'm trying to be honest, which is not easy for me at this point. And he tells me to go put ashtrays out. Now, what I felt like doing, this is the point of taking an opposite action. We do it around here, and we don't even know it. I felt like breaking his nose. But this was Irv. Now, how do you take a dog in a freeway, a guy that lives in a hostile world that has no respect or self-esteem about anything, and in 90 days, you brought me to a point whereas regardless of how I felt or what I felt like doing, nobody standing around me wasn't going to see me go get some ashtrays. I had no choice because of who he was and who you set yourself up to be to me and who you set him up to be to you. So I had to go get them ashtrays. I went to this guy, Jeff, and I said, I'm supposed to help you with these stupid ashtrays. Where are they? He says, they're back in the kitchen. Go get some. I went back in the kitchen. There was a guy back there with an old army jacket on, and he had a purple Dunkin' Butterfly yo-yo. Now, the significance of that is that when I was 12 years old in Beaumont, Texas, I won a Briggs & Stratton mini bike doing a yo-yo trick called Walk the Dog further than any other kid in my age group. And I hadn't seen a yo-yo for 20 years. And I couldn't believe it. This guy couldn't even make it go up and down. That'll break your heart, you know? I said, oh, my God, this is pathetic. And I said, it's a purple Dunkin' Butterfly. You don't find those. That's valuable. I hadn't seen a yo-yo. I said, man, I got to play with this yo-yo. This is pathetic. He says, excuse me? He said, yeah, let's go out in the courtyard. And it was like riding a bike. I hadn't forgotten. I was doing Round the Worlds and Rock the Cradle and Star of Texas, Walk the Dog. He's looking at me going, holy mackerel, what is that? I said, yeah. He said, my name's Bill. I said, I'm Frank. He says, how you doing? I said, well, I'm glad you asked. I said, I'm pathetic. I told him the story. I'm in $1,000 worth of debt. I can't get a job. You know Irv? He says, everybody knows Irv. I told him, he doesn't care. You know, that guy doesn't care. He doesn't work any kind of program. I told him this story. He didn't care. He said, well, what'd you used to do? So I told him, make a long story short, he gives me his business card. I called him that afternoon, went to work for him for the next 2 days. I worked for him for 2 years. I met my ex-wife. I met my next business partner. And I was led into the career that supports me and my son, fed his face, and took care of me for the next 23 years. I had to take a year of cake at that meeting for this guy, Bill, with the yo-yo to nudge me and say, by the way, we would have never met if you hadn't gone to put them ashtrays up. Now, how the hell does that work? What Irv know? Right? You know what Irv knew? He knew who he was here for and what they were trying to get him to understand, which is the result of having had a spiritual experience. He had had his psychic change. And it was like we said earlier and like Bill shared, our job is to pass it on. He had this crazy newcomer in his face telling him this nutso story. What are you going to do with this guy? He looks in the moment, specifically at this moment. Who needs help here? Who are we here for? What are they trying to get us to understand? If you're broken, go take on the actions of someone who isn't. If your life was complete and whole and entire, would you look around and see that that guy's going to drop them ashtrays and needs help? Would that be the actions of a wily coyote that just ate a roadrunner? He's feeling pretty gregarious and generous. And that's where we get, you know, and I took those actions and somehow providence moved. Somehow it was like the actions of someone who actually wanted to be here and was committed, and things moved. And it wasn't until months later that I looked back and see it happening. Don't leave. Never leave a meeting without knowing when your next one is. I had no idea what a priority was. I didn't know what came first. I had 20 plates to spin every day. And I was going to break them all. They were all equally important. It wasn't until I got to the fellowship that it was told to me that only through my consciousness can I have the other things that I may desire in my life. And that this was first. And it's tough, you know, you think, what the hell's going to one of these stupid meetings have to do with paying the rent? I tell you one other quick story and I'm down here. Do I have time for one more? Thank you. I've had a great time. You know, I was a little tired. Well, it doesn't matter. Bottom line is that I love doing this. And like Bill says, you got to shut me up, man. I will talk way too much. I'm such an alcoholic. But I'm excited about this thing because more is revealed to me every day and there's no defining it. When I was about 2 years sober working for this guy, Bill, with the yo-yo, I finally got enough faith, let's say, from him to go back on the road and get a credit card. He gave me a company credit card. I had 2 years sobriety, and we were doing sales seminars, and he gave me this dog and pony show. Now, this is back in 84, so there weren't any handheld video cameras, and we had to show these videotapes on this seminar. So I was traveling with two trunks, one full of books and one full of video equipment. And I would go out in these seminars and do these seminars. And they explained to me that you got to maintain your priority. And the first thing you do when you go anywhere is pick up the phone and call Alcoholics Anonymous. Find out where your next meeting is. Well, I was pretty busy on this one seminar. It was the third one. And I thought, I'll call, but I don't have time right now. And I woke up one morning. Now, let's see, I'd gone to a meeting. I was in Flint, Michigan. And I had to travel all over to do these. And I was in Flint, Michigan. And I woke up one morning and I thought, okay, I'm supposed to do my prayer and meditation, but I got a 6 a.m. flight and I got to find my plane ticket. And this is back in the days of plane tickets. You didn't have electronic tickets. So I looked all around, and this day I'm convinced that the maid threw this thing out because I couldn't find that plane ticket anywhere. And the credit card I had was a company credit card, but I couldn't use it for that size of a purchase without calling him. So this is 6 a.m. in Flint. It's 3 a.m. in L.A. And I'm calling him up, and I'm calling my boss. And I'm having to call him and say, get out of bed, go to the airport, and get me another ticket because I'm going to miss the seminar. 7 o'clock that night, I had to be in Red Deer, Alberta, Canada. No kidding. This is a true story. And that's a long way to go until 7 o'clock that night. And so that's the way the day started. My boss is going 6 a.m. to the airport, get me a new ticket. I got on a flight in Flint. I flew to Chicago. In Chicago, Air Canada's baggage handlers are on strike. So I get to handle my bags and these two trunks of equipment by myself onto the plane in Toronto. It's a Friday night Edmonton Oilers game. Free champagne flight from Toronto to Edmonton on this 727. There's hockey pucks, hockey sticks, champagne flying all around. I've had this kind of a day. I'm sitting there. They serve me dinner. I eat my dinner. There's a little piece of dessert. It's a sponge cake, white sponge cake. I went to take a bite of it. Found out later that the stewardess had an open bottle of Bacardi in the stewardess station and had poured a shot of Bacardi on everybody's sponge cake because it's Friday night party time. And I ate that cake, and that rum went down my throat, and the dragon stirred. Wiley woke up, you know, and went, yeah, this is good cake, you know. Right away, I had that sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking that bite. And I looked up, I threw my fork down, I said, God, what the heck is going on here? I need help. I hadn't surrendered all day. And to, as God is my witness, this happened to me. I looked down, the seat next to me is empty. The seat next to the window, there's a guy sitting there with a Diet Coke can crushed on his tray. No champagne. I looked around. Every other tray on that plane had champagne on it. I grabbed this guy. I said, why the hell aren't you drinking? He says, I can't drink. I'm in AA. I got 6 months. Look. And he reaches in his pocket, pulls out a 6 month chip, shows it to me. I said, buddy, we're going to have a meeting right here. And I pulled out my big book and we read chapter 5. And that took me into the rest of that trip. And I was convinced for the next 2 years that, you know, God handled seating arrangements on Air Canada, you know. I don't think that's the point of the story. I think the point may have been what my sponsor told me when I got back, which is he said, how long were you on that flight, you know, that before you noticed this guy, you know, and that's how isolated and in my head I get. And it's just one more example of how, you know, I've got to keep this thing first every day. And I'm so grateful for my life. I had such a great time coming here. Thank you for welcoming me. Have a good week. Keep coming back. That's the most important thing.